Good evening, everyone. Welcome to Carnegie Science Center and to our Science and Society Town Square presentation. My name is John Radzilowitz. I'm the Director of Science and Education here at the Science Center, and it's my privilege to be your host tonight. Our current series is called Drilling Down on the Marcellus Shale, and this is a three-part educational series that we've done. I think many of you may have been here last month for our first presentation in the series, which dealt with the geology of the Marcellus Shale. Tonight, in part two, we'll be taking a look at the environmental impact, and then we will have part three in the month of May. A little preview on that. That will be Thursday, May 19th. And the topic for that evening will be energy production. And our speaker for the third presentation will be geologist Lindell Bridges, who's currently the Senior Vice President of Geosciences for EQT Production in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. So as you can see, we're trying to cover a lot of ground with our presentations and take a look at all sides of the issue. For those who weren't here last time, I'd like to tell you a little bit about our format. We will have our presentation for about 45 or 50 minutes. We will then open things up for Q&A, and I will remind you a little bit later on, but we will have a microphone set up to the right of the stage here, and we'll ask people with questions to come on down and use that microphone so that everybody can hear the questions clearly. And then after our Q&A, we will actually retire out to the lobby where we'll have some dessert, light refreshments, and drinks for everyone, and a chance to chat a little bit more this evening. Now, tonight, we welcome Dr. John Stoltz, Professor of Environmental Microbiology in the Department of Biological Sciences and Director for the Center for Environmental Research and Education at Duquesne University. Dr. Stoltz received his PhD in Microbiology, Ecology, and Evolution from Boston University, and he's currently at Duquesne studying microbes metabolizing metals, including arsenic, selenium, and chromium. And he's currently investigating the environmental impacts of shale gas extraction with particular emphasis on water issues. Tonight, he's going to share his knowledge of the field with us and talk a little bit about chemicals used in hydraulic fracturing, how we should handle the affected water, and if there are safe ways to handle the water supply if we do drilling. And with that, I'd like to give a warm welcome to Dr. Stoltz.
Thank you. All right, let me see it. I'm going to try and do a couple of things here and hope that I don't get some feedback here. It's a pleasure to be here. I have been coming to the Science Center for many, many years. I moved here. I'm originally from New York, and I've lived in Boston and a variety of other places, but I've been here for 20 years now, and I've really grown to love this place. Okay, not just the Science Center, but Pittsburgh. And I don't know if you noticed the boat outside, the Explorer. I'm also part of the RiverQuest. And why this is important is because I've been learning a lot about Pittsburgh, a lot about the region. I think it's a great place to raise a family. And so when environmental issues come up, and this is what I've been working on a lot on, I get concerned and get involved. So my story in this was that in October of 2009, I was teaching my environmental biology class at Duquesne, and I always do a lecture on energy. And I want to make sure that my students in the class, even though it's environmental biology, understand where their energy comes from, how it's produced, and the things that are involved in any extractive industry, there's always going to be an environmental impact. And so I sat down, I said, well, what's this thing called Marcellus? I've been hearing more and more about it. And I, of course, what's the first thing you do when you want to learn something nowadays? You go onto Google. And the next thing I found, I was on YouTube, and they were exploding sinks, and there was this, and there was this thing called fracking, and it was... Well, 2.5 hours later, I was like, okay, I've got to learn more about this. And as I became more interested, I also found out about there was a DEP hearing up in Cranberry, and it was to discuss the new regulations that they were planning on putting into place with regards to effluent from various water treatment plants. and discussing that, and I heard the pros and cons and this and that. And then the other thing that was very instrumental, I met Ron Gula, and he's going to be featured later on in this. But as a result, I wound up going down to his farm. This is actually not his farm, but it's on the way to his farm in Hickory, Martin Luther King Day in 2010. So this is that picture from that January day, and it's kind of what typifies what's been going around both in this neck of the woods as well as in the eastern part of the state up in Tioga, Lycoming, Bradford, and a number of other localities. And it's all about this new process, if you will, drilling for Marcellus. So, of course, that raises a lot of questions. What is Marcellus? And, you know, sometimes I think my wife thinks I'm having an affair because I keep talking about Marcellus. When we move on to the Utica, it'll be a little easier. But anyway, so what is the Marcellus? Well, it's a shale deposit. And it's one of many that are in the United States and throughout the world. And what makes it so special is that, and you probably, if you attended last lecture, learned about that it's really organic rich, which is kind of odd for most rocks, but that it has a high organic content, and actually, if you know what to do, are able to extract methane and a variety of other things that are usable as fuel. And as you can see here from the this map here, it's an example of the different shale gas basins in the United States. And the thing is, we're actually a latecomer in all this, and things have been going on, this fracking and horizontal drilling, which I'll talk a little bit more about shortly, has been going on in places like Colorado, New Mexico, Wyoming, Texas, Arkansas, and Louisiana, for example, because they've been developing these other plays. And again, one of these little spots here is known as a play, and or a shale play. And so there are things like the Green River Formation. There are things like the Barnett. And if you've ever seen some of these documentaries, there's one that's actually called Haynesville. And they talk about, you know, Game Changer and things like that. But there's a tremendous amount of gas trapped in these formations. But they also use another term. It's called unconventional. So what's the difference between a conventional gas play and an unconventional one? Well, typically, and you know, again, oil and gas are nothing new to Pennsylvania. In fact, it was in 1859 when Colonel Drake, who wasn't really a colonel, but anyway, drilled the first oil well up in Titusville, Pennsylvania, and started the first, arguably the first oil boom. Okay, so we've had oil and gas wells. In fact, there are over 300,000 wells in Pennsylvania. And, you know, well, there's more than that. But the thing is that there's about 184,000 of them that the state calls orphan, because they don't have owners anymore. And, in fact, many of them aren't, they don't even know where they are. But anyway, the important thing is that we've had oil and gas drilling in this state for, you know, many, many years. So what makes this different? Well, in a conventional play, you essentially drill down in a vertical direction. And once you hit that deposit, it comes back up because the oil and gas are not, you know, married to the rock, if you will. Okay? And so there are things we talk about, right of capture and other aspects, so that when you looked at places like Washington in Pennsylvania, the turn of the century, it looked like everybody and their neighbor had a well in front of their house. I mean, that's how dramatic that this development was. Well, it's a lot different here because the gas is actually trapped in the rock and you have to get it released in a particular way. Now, I was mentioning some of these other things like the Haynesville. This is what they call the mother lode. Okay? And this is actually a combination of two formations, because you notice here that says Utica, but this is the central part of there is called the Marcellus. So we're going to talk a little bit about both of them. And as I said, I won't go too much into the geology. But the important thing is that this process has been going on for quite some time of the extraction. Now, if we come closer to home, and I'm sure this was discussed last time, but for those of you who weren't there, and of course I wasn't there, would have loved to have seen the talk, it actually makes this arc through Pennsylvania. So the Marcellus isn't everywhere. okay? It's only in certain parts. And then not all of the Marcellus has a lot of gas, because the more you get closer to some of this area in the state where, if I can get my little pointer there to work, okay, it's been cooked out. The gas has been cooked out. So there are certain areas that are really thick and full of the gas, and there are other places that are not. And we're going to talk about some of that, what we would call heterogeneity. But the point is that in its extent, the Marcellus is about 95,000 square miles. The rock itself is about 390 million years old. It's Devonian in age. You know, at that time, Pennsylvania was an inland sea. So the combination of things, it was a good place for organics to build up, but it also, when it eventually became rock, stored a lot of salts. So there's a lot of salts in this formation as well. And there's certain other things, including some radiogenic, or what we call NORMS, naturally occurring radiogenic materials or minerals, such as radium, uranium, and radon. So that's not all that this rock is made up of, but it contains some of that, and that's one of the concerns. So it's about 18% organics, which is quite amazing, and it is estimated to contain about 500 trillion cubic feet of trapped natural gas. Now that means, through the extent and everything else, that it's probably the second largest deposit of natural gas in the world in this particular form. Now, how do we get this? And I'm going to talk a little bit about it, because I'm sure you've heard about fracking and you've heard about horizontal drilling. Well, one thing about the shales and why they were not really, you know, why weren't people doing this earlier is because there were a lot of other closer to the surface, shallower deposits, easier deposits to get to, conventional gas plays where you essentially drilled down and the gas came up or the oil came up. So it wasn't really economic to do that, but, you know, about it's maybe 15 or so years ago, gas started trading at about, you know, $14 a thousand cubic feet, so it became economically viable. The other thing is that they were able to marry these two techniques that had been floating around for some time. One was the hydraulic fracturing, which has been around for about 60 years, where you actually send down a solution into the subsurface to blast the rock, okay, to create fissures to allow the gas and oil to escape, because they also frack oil wells. And then combine that with this technique called horizontal, where they actually can go down vertically and then have the drill bit turn and then go sideways and parallel to the surface. Now, why is that important? Well, it's important because a lot of these shale gas plays aren't that thick. So even though you could drill down vertically and frack, you wouldn't get that much gas out of the process, and of course, you know, you've made all this investment, you want to get as much as you can. So by going down, you can almost go as far, up to a mile or so, and be able to frack that and collect a lot more gas. So it's really made it a more economic process. But of course, there are some other aspects to that. So again, just to review here, this is the wellhead here. They initially drill down vertically, and then they turn the bit and they go sideways. Once they've cased this whole operation here, they will send down what they call the perf gun, which is essentially an apparatus that contains 50-gauge shot in it, and they set off explosions within the well to actually create holes so they can, or perforate it, so that's an example here. And this you've seen this figure over and over and over again on the internet. But anyway, and then after the perfing is done, they send down that solution of water and sand or propant to actually then create further cracking within the system and create these fissures to allow the gas to flow back into the well, and off you go. Okay? So again, one of the, you know, the first issue, of course, is, well, how much water is involved in the fracking process. And it's about, you know, depending on how they do it, anywhere from 3 to 5 million gallons for each well. And this process is done in several steps, so there's at least, now my understanding is that there's 8 perforations, if you will, so 8 times they do this within a single well. The other thing is that, you know, here's also, and again, as an environmental microbiologist, I'm concerned about water quality. And that the arrow there is showing the aquifer. Now, the aquifer is essentially an underground river. About 50% of the population of Pennsylvania gets their drinking water from aquifers, from wells, artesian wells, etc. And so it's really important that there be no interaction between the fluids for the drilling and the fluids for the fracking and that aquifer. So in order to prevent that, there's multiple layers of casing, so steel piping and cement. So each thing is pipe, cement, pipe, cement, pipe, cement. So this gives you an example of at least what they call that triple casing, where you're trying very hard to make sure that nothing, you know, happens to that. Okay. Now, in order to do this process, it involves a lot of chemicals, it involves a lot of water, it involves a lot of sand, and it involves a lot of trucks. So this is an example of one, and I did not take this picture. A lot of the other things I'm going to show you tonight, I personally took. I was up in an airplane and a helicopter and other fun things. But again, it shows you it's very different from your grandfather's well, in which there may be a drill rig and you know, some drilling mud, etc. But again, the typical size of one of these well pads is between 4 to 6 acres. And that's because they need to do this. And so this is just one example of what they call the spud. And this is the drilling. Actually, in this particular case, they're working on the vertical aspect of it. And these are the drilling muds, and you can see the drilling waste here. So, you know, one of these well sites will create maybe about 1,000 tons of drilling waste. Okay, so now what I'm going to do, it's been, you know, since that time and since that visit with Ron, I've been doing a number of presentations. One of them got videotaped and put on YouTube without me knowing. The next thing I know, I'm getting a phone call from Germany from a producer saying, I want to do, I've been asked by my company, which is 3SATTV, which is like their equivalent to the BBC, to do a documentary on this shale gas drilling. And I want you to help me do this. And so as a result, you know, he came to Pittsburgh and spent a couple weeks with me. He also went out to Texas and interviewed a whole number of folks, went on to well sites. We went on. We didn't go on to any well sites per se, but we, again, the fun part was getting this helicopter ride. And if any of you have seen the movie, I haven't yet, but My Bloody Valentine, I think the most recent one with Russell Crowe, there's a helicopter scene in there. The fellow's name is by the name of Cherokee. Well, anyway, Robert Richter is the director of this particular documentary, and so he put together this 4-minute video on what we did up in the helicopter. Now, he prefaces this with what's happened out west. This is an example of what's happened in Wyoming. So this is a shale play in Wyoming, and you can see how, in order to effectively and efficiently get all the gas in a particular area, you need to do this intensive drilling. Now, there I am going up in the helicopter there. That red helicopter's in the movies, but anyway. It really gives you a very different perspective of this. You could be driving around and not know that there's any well activities around. But when you get up into the helicopter, you can see how things are going. And later on, I'm going to show you some work that I did off of Google Map. There I am. I'm not shaking too much. But we did have the door off. Now, this is a well pad that is very close to completion because, again, you don't see any rig there. In the center of it, you can see where there are the Christmas trees or the well heads, condensate tanks in the foreground, some chemical and sand trucks, and you can still see the pressure trucks for the fracking. So that's post-fracking. Again, this is the new view of rural Pennsylvania with the farm, the cattle, the herd, and then the well pad. That's Cherokee. Anyway, Cherokee was the pilot. Now, this I can tell you is because of the type of well they're doing horizontal. Now, some of the other things that are involved with this, that was a compressor station. You might have heard about that. There's pipelines involved. And then this was the thing that really caught me by surprise because I wanted to know what this was. Because I grew up in New York, and we used to drive down to Washington, D.C., and we drive through New Jersey, and we drive by the refineries in New Jersey. And this is the Mark West plant that essentially separates some of those other organics from the methane. And you can see that it was, and we'll come back to that. I've got stills of that. But this is all within a few mile radius outside of Houston, Pennsylvania. And you can see how there's, you know, a lot of... So what the environmental biologists are concerned about is, again, loss of habitat, loss of forest, forest fragmentation. The DNRC did a study saying that, you know, this is a great concern. But so this is one of your pads. And you'll see in the future what's nice is that one of these pads, because you're doing directional drilling, you can actually go out into many different directions. So they can put up upwards of at least 12 wells on a single pad. So if you see here, this pad that's in early stages of development, that there are these orange, they look like bath mats. Well, each one of those is going to be a well. So it's going to go off in a different direction. And usually they'll do something like this. So you'll see, you know, the pattern of the wells underneath. Again, another concern for the environment is exactly where they're placing these things, and this is right down in you know, Washington, PA, where that particular well pad is right between two reservoirs. So if anything should happen, the probability of affecting the water supply is quite significant. So I'm wondering if many of you know about what happened last week in Bradford County, where they had a well blowout and it was streaming out fluids for about 16 hours. And it was fracking solution and it was other things. So again, these are just some of the concerns. Not saying that I'm against drilling, but I'm saying we need to do it right and we have to be careful about protecting our resources. So just to kind of put you through the take you through the process. So I mentioned it involves a lot of water. So where does the water come from? And again, this can be an issue depending on where. You know, the industry will make this comparison that there is no way that the volumes involved with the fracking are anywhere near a power plant for their cooling takes in and uses. Okay? So, I mean, it's significant, but you know, most of those power plants are located next to a major river. Okay, so one of the issues is whether or not, you know, we can put some of the smaller creeks and rivers at risk. This happens to be the a water withdrawal station at the confluence of Cheat Creek and the Monongahela. And I don't know if you can actually see this, but again, if I can tell a little funny, the company that is providing these vessels for the water storage is called Devonian Industries. So they've been around for a long time. So anyway, so then where does the water go to? Well, it doesn't stay there because that's not where the wells are. So then the water has to be transported to these impoundments. And these water impoundments are upwards of 10 acres and can hold up to 10 or 8 acres and can hold up to 10 million gallons of fluids. Okay. And this is a tried and true technology that's been done out west, although, again, another question mark. And that's all, as a scientist, I like to do is ask questions, find the answers, and then see what the analysis is at the end of the day. We're supposed to get a couple inches of rain this evening. You know, these are open pits. Question is, you know, by design, they're supposed to be filled up only to a certain extent. But again, when you're talking about experience in Colorado, in Texas, where they don't have as much rain, I think we have a lot more rain, and this is something of somewhat of a concern. But just taking a look, so here's an impoundment. It's got nothing to do with a drill site per se. Here's the drill site over here. And you'll notice that there are now, you know, good news, bad news. The good news is they're doing more recycling. The bad news is that we still have these open impoundments, so that the water and flowback coming from the, well, both the flowback and the produced water, in many cases, not all, are going back into these impoundments. So these impoundments can quickly become, I don't want to use the word contaminated, but start containing high levels of organics and salts and other things. Okay. Again, just to reiterate, this time I'm in an airplane. Boy, Robert liked to put me through all sorts of interesting and fun things. But again, giving you the perspective of what's going on in Washington County, here's a couple of houses, and then here's the well pad. Now, in this particular case, you do notice that they do have the soundproofing around it, which is very good, because these things generate, during some of the weld processes, about 95 decibels. In this particular case, let me see if I go back to that other one. Well, it's kind of hard to see. As I said, they do this in different stages. So initially, they go down vertically, and then they do their casing, and then they go in and they'll do the horizontal. So here, this is what's known as a triple. And we know these, again, as we're driving around, you'll notice them. They've got the white and the red. So typically, that's, you know, they're in the process of drawing horizontal. And you can start seeing that more and more equipment is showing up on the pad. Again, I took this picture. This one I did not take. This was provided by Bob Donnan. And he goes out every once in a while. And he's very, very interested. He got involved with this because he started seeing what they call chunky water in his, coming out of his tap, because he gets his water from PA American Water. Anyway, so you can see that it's really an intense process with lots of trucks. So you need several hundred, if not 1,000, trucks just to get the water to where it needs to be, and then you have all these other trucks. There's about 200 trucks on that site. So, and of course, this is like a nomadic thing. The well pad moves from well site to well site to well site, and again, you can see the impoundment in the back, and of course, again, you've got the different pipes. This is what it should look at the end, okay? So this is, well, there's still that impoundment there, and whether or not that was has drilling waste or anything in there, we don't know. But anyway, for whatever reason, they haven't gotten around. In this particular case, it may be that they will eventually get around to drawing off the rest of the water and restoring that area. But again, what does that typical well pad look like? Here's the footprint, again, 4x6. Here's the Christmas tree, and then here are the condensate tanks. Now, what are the condensate tanks? Well, you need that because you've sent all that water down into the subsurface, and right now, Marcellus is thirsty. Some of the other things, like the Barnett in Texas, they get about 80% back of what they put down. We're getting anywhere from 10 to 20% initially, but it eventually will all come back, or most of it will come back, and that's one of the other issues. When it first comes back, because it's initially dissolved some of those salts, it's about what we call 60,000 milligrams per liter of salt. But as it stays down there longer and more things dissolve, including the gas, it becomes saltier and saltier and saltier. So anyway, so here again, this is what your pad is. And if you apparently, well, state law dictates that within 60 days of completion, that they have to restore that site back to as close to its original state as possible. If we now go on site, and this is a site down in Avella, this is what that well pad actually looks like when you're standing on it. It's completed and everything. This is the Christmas tree. And then here's some of those condensate tanks. Now, I have to admit that this was pretty amazing to me because I'd never seen so many condensate tanks. So, again, what is the environmental concern here? The environmental concern is that, one, that all these tanks, there's actually 6 wells on this site, and so all that flowback or produced water is what it becomes, is being stored in those tanks, and that as the pressure builds up, there are these valves on the top of these tanks that actually outgas, and so there are volatiles that are being outgassed all the time. And I was just at this site again last Thursday, and you get the idea that you really don't want to be standing over here because it just there's a lot of outgassing, so there's concern about air quality here. One of the mysteries here is another one from the same property. This one only had a couple well, actually had one well, and so there's only 2 condensate tanks. But one of the other mysteries, and again, the concerns for the water, we're just asking questions. How is it possible that here's a condensate tank that is labeled hazardous? So this is a hazard placard, and it says that it's got toxic materials and flammable materials. Now, granted, you know, 2 is middling. You know, the scale ranges from 0 to 5, so this is 2, which is kind of middling. But anyway, miraculously, when it goes from the pipe to the truck, it turns into residual waste or brine. And so there's no hazard placarding on that truck. And because it's now legally designated as brine, it can go to a POTW. Again, this is a moving target. Last presentation I gave, it was still an issue. Well, hopefully it's not an issue anymore. One of the things that my colleagues and I have been doing is going out into the rivers and taking measurements, because when all those salts get into the rivers, they increase what we call the conductivity, because the more ions there are in the water, the more electricity can conduct. So it affects the conductivity. But that's a reflectance of what the salts are. So the more salts you dissolve in the water, the greater its conductivity. And so we were seeing things, measuring things like Dunker Creek and the Monongahela, and folks like Gene Van Breesen and Dan Volz, taking measurements and saying, well, there's elevated bromides, there's elevated this, there's elevated that. Where is it coming from? And then finding out that, you know, at least, and again, the numbers fly around. According to the latest missive from the DEP, there were at least 27 facilities in Pennsylvania, many of them here in western Pennsylvania, that were permitted to take 1% of this produced water in their daily intake. So the produced water had high TDS, chlorides, bromides, strontium, and barium, some radioactivity. We can talk about that shortly. But again, it was going to municipal wastewater treatment plants. So thanks to Robert, I visited McKeesport, and then subsequently I've actually been in contact and working with Pat Canavan of Clareton Works. And these folks want to do the right thing, but right now they're legally permitted to take this water. It goes for about 6 to 6.5 cents. So, for instance, McKeesport made close to $2 million last year, and it helps out the municipality. What we ask is, well, what's happening to the microbiology? Were these plants actually designed to take this kind of material? Because I work on extreme environments. You know, before I started working on Marcellus, I was working on Mono Lake in California and Sears Lake. Sears Lake is a brine that has 2 millimolar arsenic in it. You figure nothing lives there. Well, I've got the bugs that live there, and they're fascinating, okay? So a lot of this stuff, the microbiology is just great for me, okay? But the concern is what happens when it gets into the water, and then you've got folks like Pennsylvania American Water saying, what are we doing with these bromides? Because when we chlorinate the water and there's still some residual organics in it, we get trihalomethane, which is things like bromiform and chloroform. So it makes you a little dumb, but the thing is that that's not good in your drinking water. So thankfully, this past week, and we're hoping, again, because it's voluntary, it doesn't muddy the waters, that this practice of letting it, we're the only state, by the way, that allows this to happen, okay, but that the wastewater treatment plants will no longer take this. Now, of course, the feedback, and because I'm, like, in the inside now, the wastewater treatment guys are upset because they said, you know, we're coming out as the bad guys here, and we just want to make sure that, what do we deal with? We deal with your poop, and we want to make sure that we process this in a good way. So anyway, so I think this is, we asked the questions, we got some answers, and I think we're moving forward, hopefully. Okay, but again, just to show you, this is a paper, a graph from a paper that was, or a table from a paper that was published in a sedimentology journal, or petroleum journal, SEP, and it's from Rains Resources. So it is a reputable source. It's not something that, you know. And it basically shows that the total dissolved solids in these flowbacks, it says selectively random flowback water streams, you can see ranges from a low of less than 10,000 to over 200,000 milligrams per liter. Now that's 2 grams per liter, okay? And when we're making our, we've got this media that we're working with right now to culture some of these organisms. We call it frac attack, and it's really salty, okay? So we're talking about 280 grams per liter. Yeah?
This is relevant to something you just said. You said Pennsylvania is the only state that allows this to happen.
No, as far as allowing the POTWs to take the water.
POTW is?
I'm sorry, that's a publicly owned wastewater treatment plant. Thank you. Thank you for the clarification. Now, again, some of the things, and it says, as scientists, we are asking questions. We know that there's radioactivity in the material. Okay, where is it going? Do you know how often your drinking water plant has to monitor for radioactivity in your drinking water? Okay. And shale, I live in Shaler, every 9 years. Okay. So it's just, you know, ask the questions, get the answers. Is it something we should be concerned about or something not? This was the New York Times article. This is the data from the New York Times article. This is not from streams, creeks, or rivers. This is simply data that was in Harrisburg at the DEP, reported by the companies, saying what the radioactive content is of the materials. So we know, and this is another interesting thing, about Marcellus. Yeah, data from 149, not water wells. No, these are actually Marcellus wells. So it's the flow back, the water that comes back up, or the produced water that comes back up after the well has been producing the gas. So again, what are the standards? A lot of these chemicals don't have standards. When we talk about radionuclides or radioactive minerals, it's often just how much radioactivity is allowed. And granted, you know, when we say there's uranium in this material, it's not enriched. So no one's making bombs, okay? But it can be significant, and I didn't bring my little chunk. I actually went up to Lodi, New York, when I was doing a forum up in Watkins Glen, and I went to a quarry and got my own Marcellus, and it's radiating about 0.2 millirems per hour, which isn't really significant, but it's radioactive. So anyway, so what this is saying is that, yes, we just have to keep an eye on the radioactivity. The other interesting thing about Marcellus is that it's not the same wherever you go. So where we are, and the rule of thumb I've been told by folks in the industry, is stuff west of 79 is what we call wet gas, and the stuff that's east is more dry, but then as you get closer to New York State, you get more radioactive minerals. So again, and all they're talking about is gross alpha, and then and what they said, the federal drinking water standards. No one's drinking this stuff. But if we allow it to be disposed of in the rivers, someone will eventually potentially be drinking it. So that's the concern. Again, getting to the refinery, so I mentioned this wet gas. Well, that 18% organics here includes things like propane, butane, ethane, drip gas, which is almost gasoline grade. Okay, and that 50%, according to Range Resources, 50% of their profit is coming from these other products, not from the methane. But there's a cost involved, and that's where Mark West comes in. And this is this 190-acre facility just outside of Houston, PA, and it's there to process the gas, to remove the wet, and essentially they can't remove the ethane at this point, or at least that's what I was told. So that goes, and there's up to 16% of the gas is actually ethane. So thankfully, we're not producing enough of this that it's not a problem, because if you were to burn this in your furnace would burn out pretty quickly because it's not, you know, it's rated to burn methane. But anyway, so there's ethane, butane, propane. So what they're doing is they're taking the propane and the butane and they're separating that out. Apparently, that's what's going into our little tanks to fuel our barbecues. But anyway, the other thing, so that's what these towers are. And then there's also a flare because they're still flaring stuff. I asked them, couldn't you do cogen? You're upset at Allegheny Power because they can't provide uninterrupted power to you. So they could actually put in a cogen plant. And I have a colleague that works for my program who said he tried to convince them to do that, but it's not cost effective at this point. So they do burn off some of their waste organics. The other thing is that each one of these buildings here, and you'll see more of them, are the compressor stations. So in order to get the gas at the right consistency and density and pressure, they have to have these compressor stations. Back to the good news, bad news. We talked about recycling. Yes, this is a good thing to do. But again, the question is it recycling or reusing? And then how many times is the stuff reused? And then does it eventually become too salty or too organic rich to actually use? This one happens to be on McAdam Road. But you notice this, and this is a concern for me, both microbiologically and from an environmental standpoint. Those are aerators. In order to keep my bugs down from doing their thing and doing nasty stuff. Because if they don't aerate these or put in biocides, the organics build up and then the microorganisms do their stuff and produce all sorts of smelly gases that aren't good. And that, they call it, it goes septic. So what they do to help that is actually put in these aerators. So the aerators, good thing, don't have to use as much biocide. Bad thing is now you're creating all these volatiles and air particulates, if you will. So aeration is needed to control the anaerobic bacterial growth. And there's health issues involved with that. And then, of course, the pipelines. And again, a little levity here. You say, well, you're either fracked or FERC'd because fracking involves the hydraulic fracking. FERC is the federal agency that deals with the pipelines, and they bear eminent domain. So if folks want to put a pipeline in a particular place, they can do that. I have a colleague, and you might say, well, what does Dayton have to do with pipeline? But he actually used to have a 20-acre farm. Now he has two 10-acre farms because there's a pipeline right through his property. So these pipelines are showing up in more and more places. You have the gathering lines. You have the pipelines taking the gas to the compressor stations that then take it to the Mark West plant or some other smaller processing facility and then into the major pipelines. And methane is a colorless, odorless gas. So you have to put a stink in it. And so this is a mercaptan station. This one happens to be in Hickory. And the story about this is that, again, unfortunately, those wonderful infrared cameras that you might have seen footage of, you know, that are able to detect the fugitive gases like methane and other things, can't see this. We had the guy out from FLIR and we just put the camera through its paces and couldn't detect it. But, you know, if you got a good sniffer like I do, you can smell it. And the sad story here is that the town, this is Hickory, the town's slaughterhouse was right across the street, and the guy wound up just packing it up because he couldn't stand the smell. But these things pop up in a lot of different places. And so you wind up with something like this where you have a number of well pads, and then you've got the separation. This happens to be a smaller Mark West facility. There's a compressor station over here. They've just expanded that to 5 compressors. And there's at least 4 well pads within this area. This individual did not own their mineral rights. Anyway, make a long story short, there were a lot of processes, and they've since had to abandon their house and have moved elsewhere. This was the frack pond that they put 150 feet right next to the house. So again, location is everything. This is the Ron Gula place. Again, it's like, are we going down in a death spiral here? I've been to a lot of these forums, and I've heard the good and the bad and the positive and the negative, and unfortunately, I've gotten into the situation where I'm presenting the environmental impacts, which there can be significant ones, and there are certain issues that I feel that folks really don't have a clue about. One of them is that this has, you know, initially it's safe. We're doing it in downtown Fort Worth, which is true. They have almost 2,000 wells in Fort Worth, in the city of Fort Worth. But it turns out, I mean, you've got flammable stuff. I mean, the first time I visited Ron, this is what I was greeted with, which is I said, Ron, did you put that sign up? And he goes, no. And we were able to walk freely about the plant. But again, the well pads was his property, right? They were leasing it. But the next time I went to visit him, we were quickly escorted off because I wasn't wearing flammable clothing or flame-proof clothing, a hard hat, nor steel-toed shoes. And now these locations are actually encased in chain-link fence. Another issue has been, again, accessibility. You know, we are leasing public lands. We've leased one half of our state forest at this point. And I fear that they are going to be off limits because when, you know, these operations go in, clearly for the safety of the public, they need to be off limits. So here's an example in East Bethlehem Township. This is on 10 Mile Creek. I was down there because we're doing this environmental baseline study. And the fellow who was taking me around was concerned about things going on. And he said, I want to show you this. This used to be a public launch. So the folks in East Bethlehem could go down there and launch their boats onto the navigable part of Ten Mile Creek. Well, then the township thought, gee, we can make some money by leasing this to the, you know, the folks that need the water. And the next thing that went up was that it was a steel fence and a gate. And so now you have to call, and it's, you know, it's no longer public access. This is another farm, again, you know, we're saying, and I guess my issue, and I've said this before, and I just found out I was on the 6 o'clock news in Youngstown on Friday because I was at the Slippery Rock Forum. This can be done safely, okay? Don't get me wrong, that there's the technology, there's the equipment, but we're also dealing with the human factor. And if I can compare, we're at the Science Center. I mean, I've worked with NASA since I was a graduate student, okay? I love the space program. You've got all those people working to make sure that the shuttle goes up, but we've still lost two, okay? And when you think about how many missions and how many, you know, it doesn't seem like much, but we've lost two, and they're really expensive vehicles, okay? And, of course, the loss of human life. So the point here is that if you're not careful, and Pennsylvania is not Texas. Pennsylvania is not Colorado. It's not even Louisiana or Arkansas. And when you realize that there are actually, you know, at least 60 companies that are doing this drilling, okay? And I don't want to get into the good companies, bad companies type of things, but there's just so many people out there that are currently drilling. So this is one of those farms that I had shown you earlier that now those the condensate tanks, here's the chain link fence, but more disturbing is the fact that with all that water and they didn't consider the hydrology of the system, there's now major earth movements. This was not there. I mean, this is a recent development that that hillside is actually moving. We all remember what happened when they tried to put the Walmart in 65, okay? And this is the access road for that well. They can't get to their own well now because the road collapsed. So we have to be careful about where we are and understand we've got 300,000 orphan wells that we kind of get an idea where they are, how deep they are. We've been drilling in deeper than Marcellus. There's the Oriskany, which is underneath. That's been drilled. We actually use the Oriskany to store natural gas, okay, that's produced in the state. So there are all these orphan wells. Where are they? They are conduits from the subsurface to the surface. And then the other issue that nobody really wants to talk about is the drop-off rate of these wells. Okay, so these are production or what they call estimated recoveries production history for the different things. As I said, we're not the first formation to be drilled. So on the left-hand side here, you've got the Haynesville, which is in Louisiana, the Fayetteville, which is in Arkansas, and the Barnett Shale. And I always point this out. What's the time frame there? Can you read that? It's months. So, for instance, what it's saying is that basically these wells, after they've been fracked and are producing, produce 80% of what they're going to produce, unless you refrack them, and that's another issue. But anyway, in about 3 years. So what about Marcellus? Well, the early production numbers from Marcellus say that the first year decline is about 70%, that they figure that the average well is going to produce about 3.5 MMCFD. And I'm still learning some of the vernacular here. But overall, the important thing is that compared to the Fayetteville and the Barnett, the Marcellus is coming in at about 4.4 BCFE, whereas the Haynesville is still the winner at 6.5. So again, what's the take-home lesson here? Well, the take-home lesson is that because these wells really only have about a five-year life expectancy for maximum production, either you got to go back and refrack them, which you can do, or use that access to go elsewhere. In other words, use that pad access. And so the thing is, this is a biological phenomenon. It's called, you got to keep drilling, okay, in order to keep your production numbers up, to be a viable company, you've got to continually drill. So here's an example of what's been happening in Pennsylvania. I have to give kudos to the Penn State study. This is where I scoffed that, but I actually added the right panel. The study came out in May of last year, and they only had the early production numbers for 2010. We now know that in 2008 there were 519 permits, 196 Marcellus wells. In 2009 there were almost 2,000 permits and 763 wells drilled. In 2010 there were over 3,300 permits and there were more than 1,300 Marcellus wells drilled. If we look at what's going on right now, there were within the first 3 months 1,500 new permits. So if you predict that out, we'll probably have about 6,000 new permits and perhaps maybe 3,000 wells. So we will double the number of Marcellus wells this year. The other thing is, as I said, we've been drilling for decades, but what's been happening is that the ratio of conventional wells to Marcellus wells is now shifting. So in 2009, the ratio was about, you know, for every two to three conventional wells, there was one Marcellus. Last year, we were about 1 to 1. This year, we could be 2 Marcellus for every conventional. And so what does that lead us to? And I'm not going to bore you with the picture after picture after picture. You saw some of the indication from Wyoming. But again, in order to fully develop one of these plays, it involves a lot of wells. And this is a little town called Dish, Texas. I don't know if you know the story about this, that they got together and they made a deal with Dish Network that for 10 years they got free Dish TV. There's about 55 families. But the mayor of that town, Calvin Tillman, was concerned about all the activity in his neighborhood. And they've had air testing and other things. And he was so concerned that basically as of about a month or two ago, he resigned as mayor and left the town. But what we have here, this is not a suburban development here. Each one of those little subdivisions there is actually a well pad, and the road is the road to the well. So this has been happening. It's happened in Texas. It's happened in Colorado, et cetera, et cetera. For example, Green River in Wyoming, you figure it's absolutely rural. There's very little people out there. You got a lot of cows, and yes, cows make methane. But they have levels of ozone and photochemical smog rivaling major urban centers now. And in Fort Worth, 50% of their air pollution is related to the drilling activities because there are, as I said, close to 2,000 well operations in the city proper. To bring it close to home, this is Hickory and Houston. Gotta love Google Earth. It's still spotty, but for some reason, miracle, whatever you want to call it, after I went up in that helicopter in the airplanes, I was able to ground truth a lot of my observations because, lo and behold, I was up in the end of July. They had just updated their things. So this is Hickory and Houston. So Hickory is up here. Houston is over here. This is all Washington County. This is September 2005. This is now July 2010. So this was just July last year. So if I flip back and forth, you can see there's a lot of things. And just to make it a little easier for you to see, this is what. So these are all well pads, operations, whatnot. That asterisk there is the Mark West plant. So it's kind of like, you know, like the poultry industry. You got the processing plant, and then you've got the growers, and then you've got the farmers that use the manure. Where here it's kind of like you've got the well operations, the compressor stations, and all going in and feeding into the Mark West plant in order to process the gas and get it into the major pipeline. But as we like to say in biology, this is exponential. So that caused the DNRC essentially to do an assessment. We've leased half the state forest at this point, and we could very well lease the rest. And according to their estimation, if we lease any more of the state forest, there'll be so much fragmentation that it will defeat the purpose of actually having this land set aside. Because it's clear that with the access roads and other things, that it's going to be impossible to maintain the ecological integrity of these systems. So anyway, I think at that point, just to say that, you know, whether or not we can discuss if there's an issue about, you know, can you contaminate through hydraulic fracturing? As I said, the what they've been trying to do with the triple casings and things like that. They can prevent it, but there's still, like what happened in Bradford County, you get some of these things, you get a belch, you get a blowout, and you're going to have surface contamination. And then there's the issue with the POTWs. And, of course, there's always, as we say, there will be spills. And most of the violations over the last 2.5 years had to deal with improper impoundments and surface contamination. So anyway, the last bit is that the Marcellus is not the only formation. About 2,000 feet below that is a Ordovician formation, which I don't know if the geologist talked about last time. It's called the Utica. It's bigger. It's thicker. There could be potentially more gas down there. So again, as they say, this is a game changer. This industry is going to, you know, change Pennsylvania. And the answer is yes. It's going to change the ecology. It's going to change the environment. And we need to do it carefully. And we've got plenty of time because these formations have been there for millions of years and will be there for a lot longer. So anyway, I think that's where I'm going to stop. Thank you.
Thank you, John. As I promised, we'll do a little Q&A for a while, and I'm going to ask, as I said earlier, everyone who has a question to please line up and come down on this side of the stage. We'll set up the microphone here, and that way everyone will be able to hear the questions as well as to hear Dr. Stoltz's answers.
Hi, Dr. Stoltz.
Hi.
My brother happens to have some land out near Smithton, and they came and asked him for some sort of consideration. They haven't done anything specific. He hasn't made any decision. But basically, when you look at the people who are speaking for the industry, obviously, if they're getting paid by the industry, I don't think those people would hold a job very long if they keep on talking about how terrible the things were. Basically, if you had land that you were offered to have drilling in, for the Marcellus Shale, would you select to do it or refrain from it, and why?
I would say, at this point, considering what's been going on and the questions that still remain, and as I said, I've had the opportunity to talk to people from Colorado, from Texas, and wherever this has gone on, and I will say that there are probably thousands, tens of thousands of wells that have been drilled successfully, but there are a significant number of problems and a significant number of cases in which water has either been lost, contaminated, and so it really is, I would at this point, and again, I'm not here to say no, but I'm here to say, what are the alternatives? And, you know, we have a lot of dairy farming in Pennsylvania. And this is no joke. We can produce methane from, you know, cow manure. We can produce methane from landfill. People are doing it. I believe 20% of some of the methane produced in India is produced as biogas. So, you know, again, it's us scientists that have to come up with the numbers and say, you know, here's the, you know, here's the answer to, you know, methane, yeah, is cleaner than coal, but how you get it and the environmental cost of that. So at this point, I would say no if I had that land. Because, again, if you look at all the costs, what happens if you do lose your water? And now you have to buy city water. You've never had to buy city water before. Now you're going to be paying for it. In the case of one farmer down in Daisy Town, his son gets up every morning and has to do the same thing every afternoon to water the cattle. He's got 30 head of cattle. They have to use, you know, provided water to water the cattle. He never had to do that when he had a clean lake. Okay? So these are the kind of issues. And do the hydrology. It may turn out that where they're drilling is upstream in the aquifer from where you'd be affected. Now then you also have to think, well, what about your farmer friend next door? You know, they might lose their water. And just even redirecting the flow of the aquifer is enough to change. You know, there's been not contamination, but just loss of pressure and loss of water, period.
Okay. Thank you. You've just confirmed my viewpoint, and I thank you very much for giving us an objective viewpoint. Thank you.
John, yes. Thank you very much. There were a list of questions on here, and one that I focused on I didn't hear the answer for, and so I'm going to read it right off your abstract. What chemicals are used in fracking, and why?
That's okay, well, that, again, in the interest of time, I didn't want to go back right. to that, but there are a number of aspects to this. And so one of the things is you want to, well, first of all, and what I'm most aware of is the biocides. Because it turns out that, believe it or not, even down, you know, the 5,000 feet or so, they encounter microorganisms. And so they use some of the biocides. Some of them are bromine-based. Some of them are formaldehyde, glutaraldehyde, any number of things. But they have to put biocide. The other thing is that when the solution starts going down there, they can get precipitation. Some of these salts actually cause precipitation, which, again, will cause things to clog up, and so they put what they call anti-scaling agents. There's a lot of hydrochloric acid. It turns out that, you know, and I always say this, that, you know, they say, well, we put the MSDS sheets at the well site, which is mandated by OSHA, and it's for, you know, safety reasons, obviously. But I could tell you all the ingredients in my spice rack, but I'm not going to tell you what I put in my sauce, okay? Why this is important is because, again, the nature of the Marcellus is different from place to place. And so they, even if you go to some of the sites where they do post their fracking solutions, they have several different mixtures, because here in western Pennsylvania, they may use a different mix than what they're using in Tioga. So, you know, there are slickens, there are a number of other things. The propant is just a sand, yes, but then there are other things. There's surfactants to help the flow. So they're like detergents.
And so, when it gets down there, it just stays down there?
Yeah. Well, again, it eventually comes back up, but, you know, depending upon the formation, you know, Marcellus turns out to, like, really be reluctant to bring things back up. So it's going to take a while for most of that to come back up.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Stoltz. It was an excellent lecture. You mentioned salts. Now, are you aware of up to about 10 years ago, Pittsburgh and other Allegheny County municipalities would shovel up the snow, put it in dump trucks, and dump it on the riverbanks? Well, what happens to the water? What happens to the melted snows even now? They go through the storm sewers and obviously into our rivers. So the salt problem has been there. And if you're going to test for salts, I would suggest you need baseline studies from before Marcellus started.
Can I address that?
Certainly.
And absolutely, yes. And the interesting thing is that folks like Paul Zenkevich down in West Virginia and Gene Van Breezen at Carnegie Mellon have been monitoring that. And they know when the spring melt comes. And they know the contents. But it turns out, unless they've been changing the recipe that they've been sanding the waters with, it's high quality, I almost said calcite, but it's
sodium chloride.
Halide.
It's too expensive to use calcium chloride, as right. You and I should do in our
it's sodium,
own
it's sodium
sidewalks
chloride.
And driveways.
But anyway, the telltale sign for this particular stuff is the bromide. And okay. That's what we're seeing the elevation in, and it's only been in the last couple of years. So, again, there's a direct correlation. And the other important thing is that, you know, you'll see presentations where, and I'm still looking for a really complete, if you will, stratigraphic column for this part of the state. Because I was down in West Virginia in October, and I was at, I guess it's called Black Creek. There's a state park there. And one of the placards talked about that there's a brine formation that was actually mined by the locals to make salt. So we actually do have deposits and layers of brine in the subsurface in Pennsylvania. So there's a lot of stuff between here. There's also the coal. So, yeah, but I think we've been very careful. The scientists have been very careful, you know, to pose this in a major question. And, Again, our initial results seem to suggest that it is the correlation between the drilling and, the POTWs.
Thank you. You've mentioned mercaptans. If you have a leak in your basement, somewhere around your furnace or in a gas pipe, you'll be thankful to the good Lord that they do
Absolutely.
Put in mercaptans.
Absolutely.
That is how you detect a leak, because a tiny bit in parts per million will give your nose an odor of rotten eggs, and by gosh, you better call the gas company fast.
Exactly.
And they'll come out promptly. That is put in, as you say, at Mark West and other gathering stations, not only by law, but it makes good sense.
Right.
That's butyl mercaptan and has the odor of rotten eggs, but it's in very small quantities. The other thing which you did not mention, and perhaps when you came to Pennsylvania 20 years ago, Western Pennsylvania, it was too late to notice the difference. This used to be a high industrial area with lots of wonderful jobs that union leaders like in the U.S. Steel, U.S. Steelworkers were very proud of. And we were proud of, all of us in Pittsburgh. We were the sinews of the American Army in World War I, and back to the Civil War. Those jobs are gone. This is a very, very depressed place. You go up to, you mentioned Colonel Drake, yes, Titusville, Oil City, where the oil wells were originally drilled. Half the population is gone. We've lost in Pittsburgh, do the math, from 680,000 in the 70s to 305,000 now. Allegheny County, one of the fastest declining counties in the United States, and neither you nor does the EPA in Washington, unfortunately, consider jobs. The Marcellus, as I look at it, as a citizen of this area, mm-hmm. my kids have grown up here. They've all gone. There are no jobs here. They get great educations in our colleges and universities. No jobs here. And they go. The future of Western Pennsylvania could well depend on the Marcellus. And God bless our industry for recognizing this. There are people who say, pardon me, one more minute. Oh, I go out to a wellhead, and I've heard politicians like in Pittsburgh City Council say, all I see is Oklahoma and Texas licenses. And I said, yes, but come back in 2-3 years, because Allegheny Community College, Westmoreland Community College have developed programs. And you don't need a 2-year degree to be a rustabout. And the salaries are good. You go up to Bradford, PA, Pitt's Bradford campus, many years ago, had a 4-year engineering degree in petroleum engineering. Quaker State, Pennzoil, you remember those? Some of us still put those oils in our cars. They're high quality. Pennsylvania oil. They left Pennsylvania. Now, in the last year, Pitt Bradford, I understand, has reinstituted both a 2- and a 4-year degree in petroleum and gas engineering, because those jobs are in great demand. This is our future. If we don't reindustrialize this area, Pittsburgh included, is dead.
I don't agree with you. I mean, I'm part of that new renaissance, if you will. Duquesne University is now 11,000 students. We have more faculty. The University of Pittsburgh, we've got Google interested in coming to Pittsburgh. You've got the Bassmaster Classic that came to Pittsburgh. Okay?
Google came to Bakery Square, and I'll bet you $100 to a penny that that's TIF money. Our taxpayers' money are paying their rent. And for the building. They don't pay a dime on taxes any more than Lazarus did.
Well, neither does the gas industry, sir, right now, okay? There is not a severance tax, so we do not get any revenue for the state of Pennsylvania. And we're going to have issues. So, what? Well, yeah. Yes, sir.
Okay. I've got questions about the environmental impact of the frack water, and I understand that some frack water stays under. You said 10 to 20% comes up?
Right. That's the numbers of what's what.
I've heard much larger numbers. I think I've heard from the gas industry that 60% of water is recycled. I don't know if those.
No. Well, again, let's talk about the numbers. So first of all, you know, based on other plays, the numbers can be as high as 80%. As far as you put X amount of water down, X amount of water comes back up. Okay. Here in Pennsylvania, they're talking about initial flowback rates of about 10 to 20%. And of that, they can take that, they can recycle it, they can treat it, okay? And that's what they're dealing with. But again, they're still going, and every, you know, for the wells that were drilled in 2005, they still have trucks visiting and draining off the condensate tanks.
Okay. So the water that doesn't stay down there, the water that comes back up one way or another, I've heard that some of it is being pumped into deep wells in Ohio.
Right, because we don't, because of our geology, and again, it's one of those things put two and two together, because of our geology, we don't have suitable formations for deep well injections.
Okay, so what is the, I'm wondering, you know, what's the environmental impact of that? What's the environmental impact of storing frack water, produced water in impoundments for I don't know how long? Do we have any idea what fraction of the frack water, the produced water, gets dumped illegally into streams? What fraction?
Well, we don't really have we don't have a good number on that. Other than again, that's why people are testing the water to make sure, mm-hmm. because again, you know, and I will say the companies do their best to contract out, and as far as that's concerned, they don't do their own trucking. Okay, they'll contract out, and so. We just had that case where that one individual was actually illegally dumping, and he's been caught and prosecuted. But as far as the numbers, we can do studies right now, and things are ongoing at this point with respect to open air impoundments. Okay, that's a real time thing. As far as the long term, and see again, that's where I want to be involved, because what you've done is you've taken a formation that's laid dormant for, you know, 390 million years, but you've got all these goodies. And, you know, high salt, not an issue. Okay, high organics, not an issue. What's missing? The water. So you're going to have all sorts of microbial activity in these systems. And some of the data that I've seen coming out by other people, I'm not doing that work, but other folks, is indicating that, yes, indeed, there's a unique microbiology to these systems. And why I draw a comparison and why I really started getting involved with this was because for the last 5 years I've been working on a project with the DOE dealing with chromium immobilization in the subsurface. Granted, it's closer to the surface, but nonetheless, there's a lot of microbial activity in these classic contaminated Superfund sites, namely Oak Ridge, Savannah River, Hanford, where we're actually helping getting microbes to do some of the remediation. So again, that long-term storage issue is an open question, and it's going to be an important one for us to address because, again, hopefully that stuff stays down there and we won't have to worry about it, you know, in the extreme long term.
So one last thing. The Dunkard Creek fish kill, do we know, was that related to Marcellus or was that caused by some other industry?
Again, that's an interesting dynamic because the company that was responsible for the wastewater going into Dunkard, and again, they were permitted to do so, it was a combination of things because they had, you know, I mean, there was Blacksford 1 and Blacksford 2, and there was an issue with water. They were putting things down the hole, so to speak, and using it for multiple wastes. And the individual company had both coal bed methane. They had their own, and apparently they were in that particular Blacksville mine. They were hitting brines. So it was a mixture of things. The ultimate thing, though, was that the salinity of the river or creek increased to the point where there was a bloom of marine algae. And when that marine algae bloom crashed, they released a toxin, like red tide. And it killed everything for 42 miles. So basically, again, one of the things we've been looking out for is whether or not there's been a significant increase in salinity. But nothing is compared so far as to what we've seen or saw in Dunkard.
Okay. Thanks.
Hi. I just want to say that thank you very much for your lecture. I appreciate it very much. I have a background. I'm a chemical engineer. I've worked for the nuclear industry, and I've worked for the coal gas industry. In fact, I have patents in coal gas gasification, and I've worked in the gas industry. And the first thing I want to say is when I look at your presentation, I think it's slanted. Even though you say that you're presenting facts, it's definitely slanted on the environmental side. Do I see issues? Yes, I definitely see issues. I have a son that I try and make things as green as possible because I want to leave as small a footprint on this earth for his kids and his kids and his kids. So I try and make the world as good of a place as possible. But when I see you putting a slide up there that says steel-toed area, hard hat, you go into a Walmart where they're working in the back and they have those same signs. That's sensationalism. Wait a second. The other thing that I see that you have up there is, and I want to ask everybody in the room, you look down at Katrina when the well went, you know, when that well collapsed and all that oil spilled into the Gulf. Do you want to live there? You look at coal miners. Have you ever seen a coal miner come out? God bless those coal miners that give you guys electricity. They come out and they're filthy. They breathe all of that coal dust. Look over at Sensei, over at where the quake was. Where that whole area is now polluted. They can't use that area. No matter what form of energy you have, there are issues. So unless you want to turn off your air conditioning in the summertime, and unless you don't want to drive, and unless you want to grow all of your own vegetables because you don't want to go to Giant Eagle, there are going to be issues. Is this a viable energy? Yes, I really feel it is. Do they have issues they've got to address? Absolutely. But they have issues with all energies that they've got to address, and I would have liked to have seen a little more balanced in a presentation like this. That's the only thing I want to say.
I'll take an opportunity to jump in there and just remind everybody that the entire series is three speakers, geology,
so
environmental impact, and we have our third speaker who will be here next time to talk about the industry. So I think actually if you come to all three presentations, you'll see a balanced presentation.
The environmental impact, though, too, you got to look at the other side. There's environmental impacts with everything. I mean, in every aspect of life. And I would have liked for you to be a professor. I would have liked you to have been a little bit more balanced. You said a couple of things here and there that were positive, but it was definitely slanted in one direction. It really was. And that's just my opinion of you as a professor. I think you could have done a better job of presenting the facts. You had a slide up there that showed pH. You had a pH of 7. That's water. And for people who don't know that, I mean, it's like, wow, that's 7. That's drinking water. So, again, you're presenting data and facts, and unless you say, okay, and this means, you know, guys, you know that, if, you know, acid is 1 and, you know.
That particular slide was to show the concentration
again,
of the flowback.
You had a lot of data up there that was very sensational to say, whoa, what this is.
No. You mentioned numerous times that there was a scale that something registered a 2 and it could have been a 1 or a 5. So I completely disagree with you.
Well, I think he did. I don't think he was as fair and balanced as he could have been.
I think
thank you.
Hi. Thank you for coming. With the Marcellus Shale drilling, the permits that allow them to drill in the Marcellus Shale, whether it's Range Resources, you said about the Utica Formation.
Mm-hmm.
Are they allowed to drill in the Utica at a later point with those permits, or do they have to get another permit to drill for that Utica?
Now, you raise a very interesting question, and I don't know the answer to that because, again, this is one of the – it's a new question. I could tell you that if you do need another permit? Okay.
Yeah.
What?
So
the lease, if you had an open lease, you wouldn't have to get a new lease from if you wanted to go for the Utica, if you had an open lease. Yeah. Unless the lease specifically said you're going to deal. Right. Yeah.
Okay, so once you have a permit for a specific area land, you can drill as deep as you want to. Okay.
Permit tells you how you file for a permit to drill a Marcellus Okay.
What's in the lease?
Okay. Yeah, but the lease is a different thing from the permit.
The
we're talking about
the
permit.
Lease.
Right.
So are the, let's say, Range Resources, I don't really know, I'm just learning about this, but Range Resources, do they go in and lease the land for whatever's below it, if that's...
Is it? Again, it all...
Okay, so that's essentially what they're... Okay, so it's the issues aren't just now, they could be in the future.
Absolutely.
Okay. What is, we're drilling into this Marcellus Shale and maybe potentially further down. In relation to conventional gas, where you're just drilling down, is there just not enough of that gas for us to use in our houses? And that's why we're going to this Marcellus Shale?
That's a good question. You going to address that next week?
Yeah. I'll be here next week then. So right now, if we did not use this Marcellus Shale or the things on the diagram up here, we would not have enough gas to heat our houses? Okay.
So the answer is, if we didn't drill for this stuff, we'd be importing it.
I'm sorry, I didn't realize all these people are behind me. Good. Just one last question. The state parks... How much revenue is actually generated a year from the state parks in relation to what Pennsylvania is bringing in for Marcellus Shale?
That's a good question, and I don't have an answer for you. I'm not an economist, but I, you know, again, these are some of the issues that we need to address.
Okay.
They will have a royalty rate, I don't know what it is.
Yeah.
Well, I'm just wondering whether we're losing the forests in relation to the Marcellus Shale, and are we making more money for the state? Okay.
Thank you. Could I ask the remaining people to pick the one question you'd like to ask instead of three?
Thank you.
Well, I basically wanted to follow up on the tax question, so it may be the same thing that he was just asking. You mentioned in passing that we weren't charging the same taxes that other states were, I believe, and I had been at a previous lecture where Councilman Shields was speaking on this, and he's very opposed to the drilling as a whole, but he claimed that we essentially were not charging any extraction tax, that there's a fee associated with the permits and the leases and so on, but that Pennsylvania was uniquely not charging the same sort of thing that Alaska would charge for oil drilling, for example, that goes into the state general fund. And for a state that's in the midst of an energy boom, apparently the state doesn't appear to be flooded with money. The county doesn't have a lot of money. So can you address what can be done differently?
Well, I would say, and I think the industry would agree, and I actually feel, and I've talked to Jim Cannon of Range Resources and a couple of other folks in saying that, you know, the big guys really should have the tax. I mean, let me rephrase that. They should want the tax, because the problem is that right now there is no tax. And so there's a lot of people drilling in Pennsylvania. And so it's very difficult to, you know, when you say, you know, who's to blame this, whatever. And so every other state, I believe it's 32 states, most of them have what they call a severance tax. A couple of them have this other kind of funny tax, but right. Yeah. So it's about between 5 and 15%, say? 15 might be high, but... Yeah, typically 3 to 8%, and it's again, it's the cost of doing business because they realize that there are so many things that can be impacted by this. That if you just say, "Here, you know, here's the 8%, you take care of the little things." Okay,
but you're so, confirming that we don't have that now.
No, we do not.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks very much for all the information you presented. I won't ask any economic questions because I understand that that's not your field.
Exactly.
So basically my question regards the process, even in the best case scenario, and what you would foresee as the best case scenario. Would you agree or disagree that there is still a significant environmental impact? Another way of saying that is there any really clean way of doing this industry? Is there anyone who's not going to have to feel some negative environmental impact from this industry?
Well, I think, you know, and I am hopefully optimistic that, you know, there are examples where it has been successful. And then the other interesting thing is that the industry is, you know, they know a lot more about, you know, the process and stuff. But, you know, one of the things that raises... You know, questions for me is, should we be, you know, and why Pittsburgh has the ban? Should we be drilling in downtown Pittsburgh when you have this high population density? And the answer from the industry has been, well, we're drilling in Fort Worth. Well, there's clearly now, because it's been several years that this has been done, that there are issues. But I think that, you know, there are, if I say green technologies, I know sometimes that's a term that's overused. But, you know, there's closed-loop systems. There's ways of recycling. There's ways in which you can minimize the environmental impact. And then the other thing is that because we have these other formations, you know, to say that, you know, we need this gas, well, then why don't we do it in a systematic way in which certain areas get developed and other areas are offset for future generations? But right now, the way it's been going on is you see this smattering of permits and wells throughout that arc, because again, whether it's by design because they want to know exactly where they should concentrate on or not, it's just, to me at this point, it's pretty environmentally intensive. So
I'd like to know what you think that members of just the general public can do to ensure that things are done properly. We keep hearing, as you've indicated, that the things have to be done right, and they have to be done carefully, and they have to be done well. But this industry has an accelerated pace in terms of production. So how is it that individual citizens can help to ensure that things are done right and carefully and well? Some concerns about the oversight committees and people involved in the administration of our state that are seem particularly front-loaded, not to be careful and do things well, much more interested in accelerating the pace of the business side. So what can individuals, and what can we and what should we be doing?
Well, and I think that's an excellent question, because another thing, a ramification of my involvement in this has literally been a crash course in civics. So the most important thing that you as a citizen can do is get involved with your community. Decide whether or not this is a good thing. Because I was just at a meeting last night in Ben Avon. And one of their county representatives or their town representatives earlier in the week had said, oh, I signed a lease for us, and we're going to lease our town park. Well, it turns out that town park is part of at least four other municipalities. And he kind of realized that, well, he told the gas company that, or the lease company, if you will, it wasn't even a gas company, it was a lease company, that I got to have these other people agree with me. And so the first thing that happened was that two out of the five folks in Ben Avon said, no, we don't want to do this. But it also raised the specter that, you know, even in the North Hills, that, you know, there are things that are going on. Do you know what's in the mind of your local municipality? Because if there's county lands, you know, town land, whatever, they are also the ones that are going to be dealing with the variances and other things, because, you may have the private landowners who have the lease and be able to allow the drilling on their property. But again, it's not like they drop these things by helicopters. They got to come in through county and, you know, local roads and other things. And so, you know, those are the kinds of decisions that you have to make. And maybe you don't want them to put a compressor station next to a high school. And yes, this has happened in Washington County. And if I did kind of come off as a little off kilter here, it's because we've been getting all the happy news. And there are some real issues, and people who have leased did not realize that there were other things that were involved in this. So as I said, the most important thing for you to do is get involved in your local community, find out what's on the docket, because we are all on top of Marcellus. So in principle, anyone, they could actually, I mean, if the Science Center decided tomorrow that they've got this piece of property, they could drill in the parking lot. It's absolutely, and they've done it. I mean, it's been done. Okay. 150 feet. 200. Okay. Yes.
Okay, I'll make this quick since I know everyone wants to get to the refreshments, and I'm the last one. I did want to thank you for bringing up an issue that I don't think is brought up enough in this, and that is exactly what you said. Pennsylvania is not Colorado. It's not Wyoming. It's not Texas. I have a degree in geology. I'm also eventually going to be owner of property that's up near straddling the watersheds of the Susquehanna, and which is eventually the Chesapeake and the Allegheny system, which, of course, goes to the Ohio and Mississippi. Mm-hmm. We have almost unique geology in Pennsylvania. It's not the same as having the flat stratifications that you see out west. I get very frustrated when I see things such as a recently broadcast incident with the state legislature where there were three representatives who are pro-gas drilling who were showing you know, supposed diagrams of, oh, look, you know, here's this line of bedding and here's the aquifer and, oh, it's safe and it just goes down. We do not have geology like that in this state, and I don't think enough people understand that. I'm really happy that you know, educational and research groups may start to educate the people in our state the fact that it is not as simple here as it is there. I've also heard I'm an active outdoors person and kayaker. One statistic I've heard is that we have more miles of navigable streams, rivers, and waterways in this state than any other state other than Alaska. We have everything is connected up in drainage. You talk about aquifers, people see these graphs, they go, oh, yeah, they put the well casing through there. The property that I am eventually going to own has beautiful water that's coming from springs that percolate down through the top of a plateau along the Susquehanna River. The top of that plateau is owned by an old coal stripper millionaire who is now putting gas wells on it. They're going not. I don't care if they case it. They're going to have that settling pond with that crap, pardon my French, right up the hill from our three beautiful springs that percolate down through that. Pennsylvania is a folded, confused, drained bunch of very permeable strata, and people don't understand that this is a lot different than going out to the, you know, flat Texas or flat Colorado and drilling. People need to understand that. So I'm really glad you brought that up, and I hope that there's more coming from research and educational organizations to educate people about what we're dealing with here, that we stand to have a lot more damage and a lot more destruction. It's more equivalent to what's happened in West Virginia with coal stripping than it is to anything happening with drilling out west. So I'm really glad to hear that, and people need to understand it. So thank you for that.
Well, John, thank you so much. I will remind everybody, as I said last time around when we're here, that all of our speakers donate their time and their expertise for free. They don't get paid anything for this, and that's for the good stuff as well as the ad hominem attacks. And so instead,
We give you this. All we give right. you a mug to remind you of your time here at Carnegie Science Center.
Thank you so much.
We do thank you very much for everything you did. We would like to, as we did last time, continue the conversation. And as several people mentioned, the refreshments are waiting outside. I thank all of you for being here. I hope you will join us on the 19th of May for number 3. You heard a little bit from Lindell Bridges today. We'll have him on the 19th to talk a little bit more about this. Have a good night, folks. Take care.